The next case is Norman Thornton v. the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, 2021-23-29. Good morning, Mr. Carpenter.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. Thornton. The issue in this case deals with a question of statutory interpretation, specifically the provisions of 38 U.S.C. 7261b1. This provision of law was created by Congress in 2002. It is Mr. Thornton's position that since that date, the Veterans Court has never had occasion to apply this provision, and that in this particular case, they misapplied it by relying upon a misinterpretation of that that statute.
Mr. Carpenter, let me ask you the question that you're certainly awaiting. Isn't it the fact factual question whether there was a balance of positive and negative evidence and whether the disability picture more nearly approximates the criteria for a higher rating? Aren't these fact questions, and this isn't that basically what this appeal's about?
Those are factual questions in the first instance, which the Board addressed and which the Veterans Court addressed in giving due deference to those factual determinations by the Board. The error here is that that is not what is required by 7261b1. What is required by 7262b1 is a taking of due account of the Secretary's application. The error of the Veterans Court was in specifically finding that this was about taking due account of the Board's application. The Veterans Court did that under the provisions of 7261a. This is case is about 7261B1, which was created by Congress in 2002 and added to the process an additional consideration that previously only existed, or excuse me, that previously did not exist, and the only other consideration pre-existed under the APA for taking due account of the rule of prejudicial error. That rule of prejudicial error was ruled upon by this Court after its enactment, when it was part of the current statutory scheme, which included both subsections B1 and B2. And this Court in Conway found that this was not discretionary on the part of the Veterans Court, but that it was in fact mandatory.
And it's Mr. Carpenter, just to help me out, I mean, I thought what you were trying to do here was to say, we have a question about what did Congress mean when it added the language "take due account of the rule of the harmless of the benefit of the doubt."
Yes,
right. Because the benefit of the doubt pre-existed all of this. The benefit of the doubt goes back into the 1930s, as we know from these earlier cases, right? So they added some words, and it's clear that taking into consideration the benefit of the doubt rule as part of 7261A, right, in an ordinary analysis. And you're arguing that the inclusion of that language meant they have to do something else.
Yes.
Something in addition. That those words had some meaning.
Yes, then that they have to have some meaning.
Well, the Secretary, I think, is going to tell us it's hortatory. It was simply an exhortation. Because the legislative history of the 2002 law showed that there was concern from the veterans community that insufficient attention was being paid to benefit of the doubt. And so there was a lot of work going on in Congress about how do we deal with that concern. And the thought was, well, we'll change the standard of review at the board from clear error to substantial evidence. Thought about that for a while. They said, no, I'm not going to do that. And then they said, well, maybe we'll change and make clear that the CABC has the power to reverse, not just remand. So that's what we're going to do. So they made that change, and then the Secretary, I think, is going to argue to me today that as a matter of making certain you don't overlook that, they put in take due account of. And they did that because in 1988, when the CABC was created, they used exactly the same language for taking due account of the rule of harmless error.
Correct, right?
And if you look at the legislative history of that one, you'll see that was put in as an exhortation because they wanted to be certain that it was clear that the CABC had the power that an APA review court has not all courts have the power to do prejudicial error or harmless error. And so they added that as an exhortation for that reason in 88.
I'm not sure I would agree with that because
taking due account of has some meaning, has to have some meaning.
To have some meaning.
And I think basically your appeal here is just saying, please tell us what it means.
Well, that's certainly
you're claiming it has a meaning that you like, which is there's a second level of review with something in here, right?
Yes.
But the core question you're asking is, what's it mean?
Well, what does it
has to mean something.
Yes, Your Honor. And what does it mean when Congress used the phrase the Secretary's application?
I'm trying to help you with your argument that you're presenting here a question of law, an interpretation of law, rather than an application of
law
fact to settle an unquestioned law.
That's correct, Your Honor.
On this issue, the government's interesting, sort of for the first time, it's got a new way to attack you. They say you haven't presented a genuine issue.
Yes, I understand that.
You saw that, didn't
I
you?
Did.
I mean, usually they say you didn't present an issue, so they think you're ingenuous.
I've been accused of that before, Your Honor, by the government. And to me, it is a simple question of statutory interpretation, going back to the fundamental principle of if the Congress acted.
How can, assuming you're correct, that taking into account of benefit of the doubt requires some extra work by the CAVC in its review of a case when the issue is presented, right? So how can the CAVC do this to your satisfaction without running afoul of their standard of review, which is they can only upset facts for clear error?
Because
And they can't weigh facts. You agree they can't weigh facts.
They can't weigh the facts.
They can't weigh facts.
But they can take due account of what the Secretary did in applying 5107B.
Well, they're going to do that under A anyhow because under
respectfully, Your Honor,
a review under A includes not only what was in front of the BVA but what was in front of the Secretary.
Yes, Your Honor, but they do that under a deferential standard of review. What makes B1's addition?
When they're doing a review in A, 7261A, right, and they have a question of the issues presented, it's in front of them on whether there was taking due account of the benefit of doubt. So what is it that's missing in the analysis that's done initially?
What's missing is that it's a deferential review. It is
a deferential because of clear error.
Well, if you include in clear error questions
other than the clear error standard, tell me why it's deferential, the review.
Well, because it is a factual determination, Your Honor.
Let's be very careful.
Yes, the determination of whether or not there is or isn't an approximate balance of positive and negative evidence.
Right.
That is the factual determination ultimately. And when the Secretary...
And it's produced as a result of a fact finder weighing the evidence on the scale.
Yes, yes. And the Veterans Court is required to give that determination deference under the determinations under 7261A.
Wait. The Secretary is required to deference. The Secretary is, in this context, is what's going on in the whole case before it gets to the BVA.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's right. It's what happened in the RO, right?
Yes. Okay. But it's also what happens at the board.
No, because you're distinguishing between Secretary and board.
Well, Your Honor, under the legacy system, and frankly, even under the current AMA system, there are times in which there is additional evidence that is submitted after the Secretary completes its consideration that the board considers that evidence in the first instance. So they are, in fact, separate. There are times in which there are factual determinations that have never been made in the first instance by the Secretary.
We haven't made an argument here that there's a difference in how we interpret the B1, depending on whether it's a legacy appeal or not.
Oh, no, Your Honor. I was simply trying to clarify your statement that categorically it's only consideration by the Secretary. And that is simply not true in consideration under both legacy and AMA. So it covers both. And that's an important distinction because those factual determinations
I would like to take you back to where my question was, which is if I were to buy your argument that B1 tells us that something in addition to a garden variety A review of this issue of the benefit of the doubt has something extra, how can the CABC do it without violating its restriction on its fact-finding power and its review of fact power?
Because it looks at, it must review the record of proceedings of both the Secretary and the Board under the plain language in 7261B1.
They do that under A as well.
I understand that, Your Honor. But there's a separate instruction in B1 to repeat that as part of the A determination. And that when they're doing it and taking due account.
If they just repeat it, if they just do it a second time?
Yes, they just do it a second time. Is
that all you're asking for?
Well, I don't know that that's all I'm asking for.
But it's very important.
Yes.
Because if all you're asking for is for them to say, well, we did it under A, and we now have a new requirement from Thornton to do it under B, so we do it again. We just...
I understood you'd be arguing you're asking for a second time under a different standard of review.
Yes, you're right. Okay. And that standard of review must be de novo because it is mandated by the Congress for the Secretary to consider, to take due account of.
So it's de novo instead of what?
Deferential.
And deferential because of clear error.
Why is it deferential?
Why is the review of the CABC deferential?
Because it becomes a question of law, Your Honor, as to whether or not the Secretary afforded the benefit of the doubt. 5107B is binary. If there is an approximate balance, the Secretary must apply. The Secretary has no discretion, must afford the benefit of the doubt. If they find that it is not in approximate balance, and that's what we're talking about here, is the ultimate conclusion, not re-reviewing the facts, but examining the facts to answer the ultimate question.
Counsel, and you're into your rebuttal time. You want to save it or continue?
Both, Your Honor. with all due respect. But since I probably don't have that option, I will sit down.
All right. Mr. Wisser.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Before the 2002 amendments, which added the words take due account of benefit of the doubt, the CAVC was required to take due account of the benefit of the doubt in an A1 analysis, correct?
Your Honor, it's required to review the Board's decision and any findings, conclusions, factual determinations.
If the question was presented on dealing with the benefit of the doubt before 1992, the CABC was required to take due account.
Correct? Yes, Your Honor, it was authorized to review it.
So and then Congress comes along and adds B1 to something that was already required. So what does taking due account of benefit of doubt mean? Was it just hortatory, as I say?
Your Honor,
there's been some question raised about whether or not you've been paying sufficient attention. Please pay attention.
Yes, Your Honor. We agree it could be interpreted as hortatory, but we do think there is some additional work that B1 is doing here. And it's doing two things in particular. The first is if we look at the heading of B, it does clearly articulate that for these two reviews, not just benefit of the doubt, but also prejudicial error, the court should and is mandated to look at all of the evidence in the record. So there could be material, as Mr. Carpenter
suggested. They weren't mandated to look at all the evidence in the record under an A1 challenge?
Well, ordinarily, Your Honor, if there is an issue that is not presented within the four corners of the Board decision, the court is not required to address it. It can, as a matter of discretion. But if it's not presented by the parties or through the Board decision, the court doesn't necessarily need to address it. Well, we understand both subsections of B here, 1 and 2, to be telling the Veterans Court is that for prejudicial error analysis or for benefit of the doubt analysis, there might be an issue that is not squarely presented within the Board's decision alone. You have an obligation, and I think Your Honor mentioned some of the legislative history.
That's what I'm trying to get at.
Right.
Because you're now telling me that there is a question about what it really means, what taking due account of the benefit of the doubt was meant to add something.
And, Your Honor, what the legislative history suggests, it's repeated a couple times in the materials we cited, is that Congress wanted the Veterans Court to conduct what they called a searching review, meaning look beyond necessarily the issue squarely presented in the board decision and the evidence.
Searching review is something that might not have happened under A1.
That's potentially true, Your Honor, and I think the difference...
You mean that?
Well, Your Honor, what we...
I'm about to keel over with disbelief, you know, because I didn't understand from your briefs, because you thought Mr. Carpenter had presented an ingenuous issue of law.
And what I want to make clear,
Your
Honor...
Do you agree now that we are trying to interpret a question of law in this case?
In this particular issue, in terms of the standard review, yes, Your Honor. In terms of how it might apply to this case, that's the boundary we were trying to draw. That
you know, what am I supposed to think Congress meant when it said take due account? Isn't that a statutory interpretation question?
It is, Your Honor. And as we explained...
Is that squarely within our jurisdiction?
It is, Your Honor. If it's purely a question of the standard of review, that is something this court can decide. As we...
Of standard of review, I mean a standard review by the CAVC, right?
That's correct.
And that's just, yeah, so...
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so you kind of take back your on page 4, under summary of the argument, we should dismiss this appeal because he hasn't presented a question of law?
Well, it was depending on exactly what issue Mr. Carpenter was presenting. He sort of took two paths.
Well, assuming he's presenting the question we've been talking about now.
Yes, Your Honor. We don't dispute that the issue is he's presented here and that... In argument is something so, this
help me a little bit more about what it is that gets added about this searching review, because it isn't clear to me that the CAVC understood in this case. Its opinion doesn't suggest that it got it, that there was extra, because Mr. Carpenter clearly presented this question, you would agree, wouldn't you, to the CAVC?
Yes, Your Honor, and I'll answer it in two parts. I'll start with the application in this case particular, and then I'll speak more broadly.
Okay, thank you.
First, about this case in particular, I think one of the keys to understanding why the Veterans Court decision was fairly perfunctory on this issue is because, as it noted at Appendix 7 and 8 in its decision, Mr. Thornton below, didn't challenge the actual weighing of the evidence, didn't challenge the conclusion that there was an approximate balance. And so that's, the court went out of its way to note that in this particular case, it didn't really have much to do. Because as this court emphasized in the Ferguson case more than 20 years ago, really the bulk of the benefit of the doubt analysis is on the weighing of the evidence. As Mr. Carpenter, I think, agreed, the actual decision as to whether to apply the benefit of the doubt is fairly mechanical. If the evidence balanced, you do. If it's not balanced, you don't. And I would like to compare this case to one of the others we cited, which was a Mariano case also.
Well, Mariano, he loved Mariano.
He
said in his brief below, Mariano was a classic example of how they're supposed to do this.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's because in Mariano, there was actual discussion and challenge as to
there was a searching review, you would say, of the facts in
yes,
that
Your Honor.
Case because there was the challenge.
That's right, Your Honor. And
so is it your argument that this isn't the right case to decide this issue?
Well, no, our argument is more so that I think what I heard Mr. Carpenter say at the opening of his argument was that the Veterans Court has never had an opportunity to address this question and explain itself. We think it did in Mariano 20 years ago.
He agrees that Mariano was an acceptable application of the taking due account of.
And we agree as well, Your Honor. And I think really
what I'm struggling in my mind was the first place I'm getting over my shock of the fact that you're giving some credence to Thornton's statutory interpretation question and trying to help us to understand what was meant by adding it. I would have thought you were going to say that those words were purely hortatory, just an exhortation, or just make certain you do it.
And I can address that point now, Your Honor, as well. So,
but you feel it's more than that?
We do feel like there is a little more than that. I don't want to overweight it. It's, you know, obviously...
No, but I mean, if you're... This is almost like patent law. I mean, if you open up a crack this big in how veterans' cases are administered, it's a crack that's the Grand Canyon.
Well, and this is why, Your Honor...
We have to be very, very careful in what we say if we're going to be giving instructions to the CAVC about how to do things.
That's right. And this is why, Your Honor, we don't feel like this is necessarily a totally novel issue because of the fact that we have these two provisions in parallel next to each other under the same heading. And so as this Court and the Supreme Court has explained multiple times, you have to interpret them similarly. We have the Tadlock decision that this Court issued last year discussing how it means to take due account of the rule of prejudicial error. And this Court explained the meets and bounds of that analysis, and we believe those same meets and bounds would apply here as well, to say that when Congress was directing Veterans Court to take due account of either rule, it is opening the door a little bit. It's saying, you know, there might be something in the underlying record that the Board didn't discuss or the parties may not have even presented to the Board, the court does have an obligation to at least do a check, to at least do a review of the underlying record and make sure that there's nothing anybody missed. But that is a fairly narrow and cabined analysis, as this court made clear in Tadlock. The Veterans Court is not empowered to make factual findings in the first instance.
Okay, let's just slow down for a second.
Yes, sir.
So if you don't mind, if this extra review is going to be made to make certain that there isn't something in the Secretary's record that got missed, how is that an independent, that's an initial review, the CAVC is doing that in Mr. Carpenter's words, de novo? Is that right?
No, we don't believe it's a de novo review as to what the Secretary is doing.
We need to know the word.
Yes,
what
sir.
Is it? I mean, what,
so the other limitation that's here in the language.
When three judges of the CAVC lean back and say, now it's our turn to do a deep dive to see whether there's anything in the record that got missed.
Right, Your Honor. And we would.
What are they doing?
And we would point to the very first clause of subsection B, which says, in making the determinations under subsection A. So it's very clear that this is a subsidiary analysis. It's not a totally new second analysis that's being done here. It's just that in conducting the deferential review, reviewing factual findings for clear error, otherwise reviewing for arbitrary, capricious, contrary to law.
Isn't that something that they were obligated to do before these words were added?
Your Honor,
wouldn't we have reversed them if they hadn't done that?
So I think
this extra look, because the statute is very, very clear that the record that's in front of the CAVC in every case it has is the record that was in front of the Secretary and the record that's in front of the Board, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the entire record is there already. And when an issue is raised, right, is this what you're trying to tell me, is that maybe a veteran forgets to raise it himself?
That's where we believe there might be a slight difference here, Your Honor, in what the Veterans Court was obligated to do before this amendment
sort of
and
like
after.
It's like it was a pro se person, even though they have a lawyer, we're going to do this extra look?
That's right, Your Honor. We understand B1 to be affirmatively directing the Veterans Court to make sure that the rule, the benefit of the doubt rule, was applied correctly, even if perhaps it was not squarely addressed by the Board and not raised by the parties. But if
I think you've been very clear about that. When you started, you said there were maybe two things that you thought the due account requires beyond what A already required. Have you told us what the second thing is?
So the second one is, and I don't think there's much disagreement here, the second one is what this court explained previously, which is that it empowers in this Conway decision, the Veterans Court to simply reverse. That if the Veterans Court does find that there was some underlying clear error in the determinations, the Veterans Court's empowered to reverse. It doesn't have to remand.
And that couldn't be done under A before B1 was added.
That's correct. And that point has been addressed by this court previously.
That looked like it was part of the compromise as to how we're going to try to ensure there is more careful attention paid to this particular issue.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Now, did you have an opportunity to do a little deep dive in the 1988 legislative history?
Not as much in this case, Your Honor. I did some in the Lynch preparations. But
it's not there, right? Not the same amount?
No, Your Honor.
So my recollection of that legislative history was that it was primarily a question as we're creating this new court, and we're going to give this court some powers, right? And so we go down the list and give them the powers. And they're talking about, well, should we give them complete APA review like substantial evidence?
That's right, Your Honor.
And they're not going to do that, but they wanted to make certain that at least this aspect of the APA was front and center, correct?
That's correct. And I think Your Honor summarized.
But there wasn't any legislative history of the Secretary coming in and saying, oh my God, the BVA has been failing to apply prejudicial error.
No, Your Honor. We didn't notice any of that. And I would also point out.
Do you know,
I think,
as a matter of history, whether the BVA did apply prejudicial error before 1988?
I will admit I don't know off the top of my head, Your Honor. I don't want to speculate on
that.
It'd
be interesting to know.
Yeah, I don't know that, Your Honor. I would point, though, I think Your Honor summarized the relevant legislative history here for 2002 fairly well with Mr. Carpenter's presentation, but I would specifically address the court to page S11337. Which is of the report that has the joint explanatory statement from the House and the Senate Veterans Affairs Committees. And on that page, they specifically said, as Your Honor summarized, we considered modifying the evidentiary review standard. We considered lowering it to substantial evidence one step above de novo, but we decided not to, and it was specifically stated that we did not because they did not want any additional confusion about how this was going to unfold. They believed that the existing standard of review was clear, everybody knew what to expect, and they did not want to inject further uncertainty here, which is exactly the position that Mr. Thornton is attempting to do now. Congress considered it and foreclosed it.
5107B is the statutory basis for the application of a benefit of the doubt rule, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, it only refers to, I think, the secretary. It doesn't refer to the board. Is that right?
That's right, Your Honor. And this gets
I don't know if that helps you or hurts you. Can you say on that?
So I think we acknowledge that there is some inconsistency in 7261. In some places, Congress is referring to secretary and the board sort of in serial. Sometimes they're referring just to the secretary. We do acknowledge, and I don't think we've ever disagreed, that the reference to the secretary throughout is generally understood to be comprehensive and includes the board acting as the secretary's agent as well as the general process leading up to the board decision.
So you agree, notwithstanding 5107 not calling out the board has an obligation to take account, correct?
And we would point out that if you were to take that exclusion literally to say that because in 7261 there are some places where Congress references secretary and board and some places where it just references secretary, if you were to take that literally, then B1 saying take due account of secretary's application 5107 would foreclose reviewing the board's application in the same way 5107 would require the secretary but foreclose the board from applying the benefit of the doubt.
Or at least wouldn't require the board to do it. I don't know if it would foreclose it.
Well, but if we're going to take the implication that Congress was purposeful in dividing out secretary versus board in 7261, and there's a cross-reference to 5107, that could be read to mean that by implication, the reference exclusively to the secretary is exclusive of the board in 5107. And we don't think that's correct. We think it actually probably went the other way, that because 5107 is general, it refers to the secretary. We've always understood that to include the board.
The obligation obviously begins at the RO.
That's right, Your Honor.
That's where it starts.
And we've always understood 5107 to be secretary in the broad sense, right? The way Congress usually writes statutes, it specifies the agency head, and then there are further delegations that may be enacted. So we actually understand the logic probably went in the reverse, that when Congress was expressly cross-referencing 5107 here in 7261B, it likely was just referencing the secretary as shorthand because that's what 5107 says.
But then why does that allow the court to fulfill its obligation under 7261B by only talking about the board and not also expressly talking about the secretary?
Well, it doesn't, Your Honor, and that's what we're trying to say is that we understand B1, the secretary's application, to be secretary in the broad sense, that it includes all
and therefore it can be satisfied by only reviewing the board?
No, Your Honor. We don't disagree that the underlying record to be reviewed is the full record, starting from the initial claim all the way through the board decision.
That's clear from the face of 7261A.
Yes, Your Honor. And so we don't understand that this reference to the secretary in B1 in any way cabins that. That it is still the full gamut. You start from the very beginning of the claim all the way through the board decision. That is the record that the Court of Veterans Claims
is reviewing. So it's basically taking due account of is that when a case gets to the CAVC, they look at the entirety of the record and they make certain that any evidence pertinent to the question of the benefit of the doubt has been observed and has been dealt with.
That's right, Your Honor. And I will, in my last minute here, if I may just make one final statement, Your Honor, I would just again reemphasize that this makes a lot of sense tied together with the rule of prejudicial error. Because as courts recognize all over the place, when you're looking at prejudicial error, you're necessarily maybe looking at something that the underlying tribunal didn't look at because you're engaged in a counterfactual analysis. And so the court is instructed to go beyond the four corners of the lower decision. And so it makes sense that these two provisions are paired in that sense in terms of adding that little bit extra Congress was directing the court to do, to say go beyond the four corners of just the board's decision and make sure that there is nothing in the record that would otherwise implicate or find a clear error in the benefit of the doubt analysis.
Since we know that Congress has specified that there are two issues, one typically favors the secretary and the other typically favors the veteran, are two areas where the deep dive is required by the CAVC to inspect the entire record to make certain nothing got missed. Can I assume that with respect to all other veterans law issues, the CAVC does not have an obligation to do a deep dive?
Not an affirmative obligation in the same way, Your Honor. Obviously, if there's an issue...
What does that mean? I mean, this is canon fodder for your colleague here for future cases, I'm sure, but...
Well, because, Your Honor, the review under subsection A is well-defined. It's the APA review. You look at the decision of the lower tribunal in light of the underlying record. The only thing we're saying
but
that...
But I mean, the obligation to do that with regard to all issues in veterans cases exists under 7261A1, right?
That's true, for issues that are preserved and presented. And so what we think subsection B is doing is adding a little bit beyond that to say the benefit of the doubt rule might be reviewable even if not preserved and presented in the same way an ordinary issue might be.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Argument. Mr. Carpenter, we'll give you 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Well, you're feeling better, right, Mr. Carpenter?
I most certainly am, Your Honor, because I apparently read a completely different brief than what is now explained.
I didn't see the fine-tuning that we have now.
Well, and that's frankly because, Your Honor, this is a very subtle area.
Right. So assuming that I agree with your adversary here, do you have any problems?
I don't have a problem, no.
Isn't he in essence embracing your embracing of Mariano?
That's exactly what I heard, Your Honor. And that something more needs to be done.
Okay, but I mean, is that, assuming that it has an opinion, would be written in this case, because you did present a question of law for us to review, then isn't the embrace of Mariano the answer here?
It is, Your Honor, except that it doesn't give the Veterans Court a clear understanding of what it means to take due account of the Secretary's application. And I think that's
You heard the exegesis from your adversary here about what it really means. It's this deep dive to say and make certain. And I thought you would love this because he said he's suggesting that even if the fact question wasn't presented.
Wasn't raised. Absolutely, Your Honor.
So that was what puzzled me. I didn't have a chance to pursue with him when he sat down, but he was suggesting to me that even in a case where the veteran hadn't presented the factual challenge, as you did not,
yes,
in this case, there still was a duty to deep six look at the record.
Yes, because that's what Congress meant when it
added
this.
I didn't get a chance. I mean, I wish I had a chance to talk to him again because it's like centrally important.
But I think also centrally important in this case is to communicate to the Veterans Court what they are to do with the taking due account of. Are they, when they take that deep dive and they collect all of that evidence, how do they determine what are the parameters of their obligation under 7261B1?
In that regard, in this case, did the Veterans Court take sufficient due account of the board's application of the benefit of the doubt rule? And I emphasize board because I know you say they didn't do anything with respect to the secretary. Did they at least do enough with respect to the board's application of the rule?
I don't believe they did, Your Honor.
And
that's why I'm going to this last point, because it seems to me that understanding how you address as a reviewing court whether the evidence in its totality based upon this deep dive, is or isn't in approximate balance. To me, this is a completely different issue than was recently dealt with by this court about whether or not preponderance of evidence is the standard.
Can you help us just a little bit on what they failed to do to meet their obligation to take due account of the board?
Right. They failed to look at the actual evidence and determine whether or not that actual evidence required the application of the benefit of the doubt.
They needed to make a fact finding.
No, it is not a fact finding. It is a legal determination as to whether or not there is or isn't an approximate balance. We have to make that a legal determination because elsewise you undercut the entire point of having the benefit of the doubt mandatory.
But Mr. Carpenter, you didn't challenge the facts.
I did not, Your Honor.
Let's just stop right there. The statute requires the CAVC, to the extent necessary, to a question when presented.
Yes.
So you did not present a question of whether or not the facts were correctly found by the board.
And to that extent, then I may not be able to answer Judge Stark's question.
My question is...
The government has conceded that this 7261B1 goes beyond A, that there are things...
No. He did not say that. He said that B1 is a part of A.
It is a part of A, but it goes for a deep dive into all of the evidence that is of record.
Even if not presented. That's your view.
And that, yes,
and
that is my view.
To interpret what presented means in A.
Correct. Because...
Well, that's not briefed or argued?
No, Your Honor, that was not briefed.
Look, Mr. Carpenter, if we're going to write an opinion where we say the CAVC, at least with regard to these two issues, benefit of the doubt and prejudice layer, that even if the issue isn't presented to the CAVC by a pro se or by a lawyer, the court still has an obligation to do a deep dive.
Yes.
That is earth-shaking, as you understand. You know that.
I most certainly do, Your Honor.
Ground is shaking right now underneath.
Because that was what, as you pointed out, existed prior to judicial review and has existed since the 1930s. This has been the fulcrum under which the specialness, the uniqueness of the VA adjudicatory system is the benefit of the doubt.
A lot of time. I don't know whether my colleagues are. I would benefit from additional briefing on whether or not this B1 test requires that the CAVC review an issue not presented to it, i.e. the facts.
I would be happy to do that, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. You ought to be able to do it in 20 pages or less, or sort of with citations,
yes,
if you can. I mean, if we are going to hold that the statute says that the appellate power of the CAVC is limited to issues presented to it, and you're telling me that B1 has changed that law,
yes,
to say that at least with regard to B1 and probably B2.
And that, well, yes, Your Honor.
It would say in its decision, and when presented, except with regard to B1 and B2.
Do we want to request additional briefing?
Yes, I'd like additional briefing.
Simultaneous.
Excuse me?
Simultaneous.
Yes, simultaneous.
20 pages or less?
20 pages or less.
By?
2 weeks.
2 weeks will work for me. I've got a second argument.
I don't want to press the government either, but I mean...
Your Honor, give me a chance to read my calendar for 1 second.
2 weeks, and if you need more time, give us a motion requesting and telling us why. But... Am I wrong in sensing that this is a very important issue?
Oh,
that will...
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
I'm looking at the government, too.
Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Let me just look at my calendar first. So 2 weeks brings us to Monday the 19th. If we could have maybe just the end of that week, which
sure
would be the 23rd,
sure.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you,
I think we have both arguments, and you can be sure we'll take due account of your argument, both of the arguments.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is submitted.